The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower and Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. As usual, I'm here today with a thought leader in the government market. Today, welcome back to Larry Allen. Larry, thanks for coming in, man.
Mark, pleasure to be here.
Is there anybody out there that doesn't know what you do? Tell them.
There may be one or two people. I've been working with companies now for 5.5 years after 20 years at the Coalition for Government Procurement, working with firms that sell to the feds on ways to improve their business with a heavy dose, Mark, on compliance, keeping people out of trouble. It's not how much money you make, it's how much money you keep.
Well, you know, it's funny because there was a compliance issue that we'll probably touch on a little later on in the show in your latest newsletter. So, and if you don't get Larry's newsletter, it comes out Monday morning, usually between 10 and noon. Go to allenfederal.com and sign up for the newsletter.
It's free.
Yeah. What's ahead? What the heck's the name?
The Week Ahead.
The Week Ahead. Something like that. The Week Ahead. It's good. Very short read, very pertinent issues. So talk about pertinent issues here. We've heard a tremendous amount about category management of late, and I know you have a few thoughts on the matter. So take it away.
Well, Mark, what's interesting to me right now about category management is a recent proposed rule that was put out that some are interpreting to require federal agencies to either use one of these preferred category management methods to buy things like IT or professional services or products, or do a justification on why they're not going to use them. To me and a lot of other people in the acquisition community, Mark, this is about as close to mandatory thou shalt guidance as OMB is going to come these days. And it really, I think, starts to take category management in the wrong direction. You might remember category management started out with being a way to leverage the government's combined buying power, but doing it with more of a carrot than a stick approach, Mark, where agencies were supposed to use any one of a number of preferred acquisition methods for things like, say, desktop and laptop computers. And it worked so long as it was seen as a carrot approach and best-in-class, best-practices type of things, and agencies like that and appreciate the guidance. But when you start to shift over to a thou shalt, and this is a mandatory program or a mandatory set of contracts, that's the first step towards ensuring that your program is going to end most likely in failure. Given the history that you and I have both seen in federal acquisition, the minute you tell a federal buyer they have to do something, that's the reason they're going to find to do something else. And that's going to be a problem for category management if they continue down that path.
Justification. Don't want to.
That's right. We don't want to do a justification. And look, what's the real there? Well, look, what happens with any one of these, and we've seen it, we could tick off between you and I any one of 10 government contracts where we've seen this happen, where as soon as you say you have to use this because it's the better price, somebody out there is going to find a better price, often for newer technology than what's on that preferred or mandated procurement vehicle. And that's going to be their justification. And that's the type of stuff that makes it into the media and press. And then so pretty soon people are wondering, why were we doing category management in the first place? And that's an issue because it had been working. And now I'm thinking that if OMB continues down the mandatory path, it's definitely like snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
And what contracts would this apply to? Or is it contract neutral? Or
Well, that's the confusing part, Mark. The proposed rule uses kind of an outdated term. It uses Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative, FSSI, and we know that there are really, what, two of those left right now, one for office supplies and one for janitorial and sanitation supplies. But most people are reading this rule to really say, look, this is beyond FSSI, and it goes to category management. I alluded to the desktop last laptop initiative. There's guidance out from OMB under category management on the type of software contracts that you should be using if you're buying software. There's new guidance out for digital services and things of that nature. And so the belief is that once this rule firms up, it's going to capture all of those preferred category management contract methods and make them mandatory.
Mandatory. Okay, yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't say that as soon as the phrase category management came into play, our friend up in New Jersey, Dr. Sam, or Professor Sam Bornstein, was saying, this is FSSI with a new name.
And this is, I think, what's being proved out. As usual, the professor was ahead of the curve, but everybody that I've spoken to is anticipating that this is, in fact, what that means for category management, Mark. And look, just when I thought that category management might live to see a new presidential administration, that it made good inroads, and people at different agencies, especially GSA, were working on their own plans, you take it and you flip it over from something that works into something that's going to get people's back up. History is not on your side.
No, no. And, you know, again, different times, different names, but there have been other pushes in this particular direction. But speaking of OMB, the last couple of memos that have come out of OMB have come from someone with a new job title.
Federal Chief Acquisition Officer, our friend, and she is a friend, Ann Rung over at the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, who, when she was confirmed by the Senate, was given the title of Administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Suddenly, she is now the Chief
U.S. Chief Acquisition Officer.
And that's raised a lot of eyebrows, and it's been a distraction. And frankly, it's something that didn't need to be a distraction. When you're talking about serious things like category management, you're talking about some of the other OFPP initiatives to reduce government overhead and improve acquisition and spend under management, Mark. When you have something that somebody claims a new title for themselves, it's kind of like everybody's, come on. And other people have made the comment that I think is a good one. The Chief Acquisition Officer in other federal agencies, well, they're actually responsible for buying things or for having oversight, but at least they have some procurement authority,
right.
Whereas the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Administrator does not. And the acquisition
policy.
Yeah, exactly. And the acquisition community, look, is justifiably proud of the credentials and training they've taken to get their designations as warranted contracting officers. And they take umbrage at people who afford themselves titles that perhaps others feel that they've worked a little harder to get.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people who are certified level two, level three, and they were not amused.
Well, certainly not. And again, you know, this is something that didn't need to be a big deal, and it's kind of silly, and it's a distraction. And to me, I've always thought the title Administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy was kind of neat, and it's Senate confirmed and presidentially appointed. Mark, I don't know about you, but anything that comes with that type of pedigree, I don't care what they call me, it's kind of a neat thing to have, and very few people can obtain it.
Point. Good point. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You can find Larry at Allen, A-L-L-E-N, federal.com. We shall return. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here today with Larry Allen of Allen Federal. Larry, way, way back when, this guy who was the U.S. CIO said, cloud first. saw an article in Federal Computer Week this week. Last week, saying that VA is using CIOCS, a GWAC, to procure cloud services, but they were looking for not services, but for a broker. So how long ago did Vivek introduce the idea of cloud? Is this 7+ now?
It is 7+ years, Mark, since the introduction of cloud computing as an idea in federal contracting. And what I find fascinating is that despite the advantages of lower cost and increased productivity, federal government generally has been slow to adopt cloud solutions. And the primary reason why is security concerns. And this was underscored by a recent survey done right here on Federal News Radio that showed that just a little more than half of federal agencies had tried at least one cloud solution. And of those agencies, most of the cloud adaptation, Mark, had been on things that are low-hanging fruit, like applications, things of that nature, email. Federal execs basically just feel safer if they have more direct control over their data. And if those are not going to be cloud-based, or if they are cloud-based, they're going to be in what, quote, is a government-only, end quote, cloud, which may not look like the clouds we studied in science at all.
Where's my punch card? I had the stack right here. This is intriguing because, you know, June was a month rife with events, and I'll call them non-events and just not mention them. But one of those events was Amazon Web Services, that hosted their first big government thingy. Over 7,000 people registered, over 5,000 people attended, overflow at two hotels, 100 sessions that were friggin' packed. And we're talking not with contractors, but with feds.
Well certainly in the federal market today, the federal cloud market, Mark, the leading provider by far is Amazon. They've been very aggressive in this market. And one of the things they've had to do is earn the trust of skittish federal CIO types. And they've done a fairly good job at it. Some may say that they've had an inside track because Amazon very much in favor with this administration. But really, that only gets you so far.
Yeah.
That only gets you a start. And they did have a huge event. So there's potential. And we have events around the Beltway. You could go to a cloud event, even in the summer, 4 days out of five. And in the fall, it could be 6 days out of seven. The hype, though.
Sunday Mass.
Right.
Cloud.
Sunday Mass in the cloud. The hype, though, Mark, really hasn't matched the pace of adoption. And that's the thing that always fascinates me. We have people in industry that talk a lot about cloud, industry contractors that spend a really large amount of time developing a cloud strategy for federal contractors that have sunk thousands and thousands of dollars into getting FedRAMP accredited in order to be able to sell their cloud solutions in the first place. And there are just an awful lot of players and only a few chunks of what of any a business of any size. And to me, that you'd like to think on the upside there's potential, and I think there is. But the frustrating thing, and this was borne out in the survey, is that here we are 7 years later and we still have to be talking about the need to move to the cloud. Dave Winogrand over at the Professional Services Council said that in the report that was issued, and he's absolutely right. When are we going to stop talking so much about it and get to it? There's a lot of upside. And if you look at the private sector market and the commercial marketplace, Mark, they're not having these conversations because they've already taken the steps and realized the savings, and they're on to things like the next generation.
Yeah, the CFO and the CIO sat down, looked at it and go, no loss of functionality, improved functionality, lower cost. What's the problem?
That's right. And all of it's taking place in secure environments. Now, to be fair to the feds, look, very few private sector officials get hauled before Congress if they have a data breach. They may get hauled before their investors if they're a publicly traded company. But feds have the real and legitimate concern if they do something innovative that Congress or their agency IG will take a very dim view of it if something goes wrong. Those can be career-ending moves, and I think that explains a lot of the reticence. But that doesn't really excuse the climate. We shouldn't be living in out of fear and making decisions out of fear. We should be making smart business-based decisions. And as we've alluded to, there's a lot to be saved and a lot of functionality to be gained by making this transition.
Well, it's funny because the theme of Dilbert over the last week or so has been, you know, pointy-haired guy telling Dilbert and Wally to, you know, think like entrepreneurs, but run all your ideas by me for an okay. but, you know, same thing. I saw Alan Shavatkin at a Wash Tech event the other day on open source being a disruptor. And Alan's thing is, you know, the risk-averse culture just isn't ready for a lot of this change. It's not, you know, the bimodal approach that the David Ext of Red Hat was talking about. They're just not ready for this.
No. You know, even though we have the federal CIO talking about the need to buy new and to not spend as much money on legacy IT systems. In the president's budget for the next fiscal year is a $3 billion proposal for innovative new IT that supports that message. It's a difficult message to sink in, Mark. The federal IT ship is indeed the aircraft carrier that takes a long time to turn around.
Yeah, and the mindset of the captain is, why do I want to turn anyway?
Right. I know the direction that I'm going in. It may not be the fastest or most effective, but I know this map, and I'm not going to get in trouble if I go this way.
Right. And if I go the other way, I'll fall off the edge of the earth.
Here, there be.
all right. We are going to migrate there sooner or later. We have to migrate there sooner or later.
Well, I think there's the trend line is that way. There simply won't be the support available from commercial sector contractors for traditional methods of maintaining IT systems. Everyone is moving to the virtual cloud model, and that's ultimately, if you still have Windows 5 on your computer, nobody's supporting Windows 5 anymore. You really don't have a choice but to upgrade. It's time to get with the program and realize what the new technology can do for you. And inevitably, we will see that in the federal world. But at the same time, I think we can anticipate agencies to use a belt and suspenders approach. So for all the contractors out there offering cloud solutions, you know that security is the first, second, and third concern of your customer. I think we can anticipate seeing an awful lot of solutions offered with belt and suspenders that inevitably will satisfy or may satisfy these cure needs, Mark, but probably cut into some of the savings that could otherwise be realized.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be duct tape, but you're going to run out of guys that can write COBOL.
At some point, they're just not going to be alive anymore.
Right. So, all right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark Amtower. I'm here with Larry Allen, and we will return after these messages. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. I'm here with Larry Allen of Allen Federal. Again, you can find Larry at allenfederal.com, A-L-L-E-N, federal.com. Larry, there's a couple of things about DOD that that we really need to talk about. And I'll leave the order to you. We have the acquisition reform aspect and the Palantir, which...
And we just had been finishing talking, Mark, about cloud computing and the reticence that agencies used to talk about cloud. So the Palantir case, I think, is a follow-on to that. You know, we have here a company that had, by all reports, an extremely innovative commercial-based technology solution that, when demoed to the Army in this specific case, apparently blew the Army's doors off in terms of functionality and capability. And yet when the Army went out for their distributed common ground system procurement, the RFP was written in a much more traditional manner that seemed to not allow for the offering of a commercial-based next-generation solution. I put this under the heading, Mark, of everybody talks a good game about wanting innovation and wanting to use the latest technology, and yet when provided with the opportunity to do so, you find a number of federal agencies that are much more likely to say, no thanks, we like our somewhat outdated application, at least we know how it works, and innovation goes by the wayside, often at the price of an increased cost to government along with reduced mission capability. Now, putting aside for a minute that Palantir has actually protested the Army's RFP on this distributed common ground procurement, it's always interesting to sue your putative customer. But putting that aside, look, if we're going to talk seriously about innovation in the federal marketplace, we have to have people in the federal marketplace that are willing to do innovation on a larger scale. Not everything can be done on the scale of 18F, Mark.
Right. So how odd is it, or how rare is it, that somebody sues over the RFP, though?
Well, it's not as common as a post-award RFP, but there certainly are many cases each year when a contractor will sue over an alleged error or file a protest over an alleged error at the RFP. This one may or may not be seen as a Hail Mary case. The court has yet to rule on the merits of the protest, Mark. But the aggressive manner in which Palantir has been pursuing this, it's not at GAO, it's at the Federal Claims Court,
yeah,
which is serious and expensive.
And you don't go from Federal Claims back to GAO.
Back to GAO, no.
It's the other way.
It's right. It's kind of makes everybody stand up and take notice. And look, GAO protests, even the pre-award phase, are fairly common. But when you take somebody, your putative customer, to Claims Court, that has to be a considered decision in terms of your overall relationship management dynamic with your potential customer.
it'll be fun to watch that one play out.
It's interesting, and I think there are an awful lot of people, Mark, who are interested to see how this will play out, both in terms of what ends up being decided on the merits of the protest and how the Army may or may not move forward in terms of a more innovative approach than the one they originally decided to go with, but also in terms of how Palantir is viewed, not just at the Army, but by other DOD potential customers, knowing that the company might take you to court if you are overly proscribed on your needs.
Okay. One of the issues in your newsletter this past week was be careful what you ask for with acquisition. Actually, it was the lead article in your newsletter, right. And I found it particularly interesting.
Well, Mark, everybody is talking about acquisition reform again. You know, it seems like the 1990s all over again, but here we are. And in fact, the Congress last year, through the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, implemented a series of acquisition reforms largely targeted at DOD. But the idea was that everybody would be coming back again this year, perhaps next, with broader spread acquisition reform at the forefront of the government management agenda. And everybody tends to say, yay, acquisition reform, Mark. But my point in my article is, look at the environment in Congress today. Look at the dynamics that are going on. This is the most partisan political spectrum we've had any time in recent history. Any member of Congress.
Since about 1858.
It's since the 1850s, exactly right. Although you might have to ask Mike Causey about what that was really like. But having said that, even when you talk to staff or senators or members of Congress, they will all tell you that this is a very partisan environment. And so that got me thinking, so wait, acquisition reform can cut both ways. I mean, the good news, bad news story is that there are relatively few people on the Hill who really understand federal acquisition. Right now, I think that has the potential, Mark, to be more bad news than good, because what they might consider to be a reform, people who actually want to see government acquisition work might view very differently. So
it'd be interesting if they asked 1102s what they thought first.
Right, which, you know, won't happen in this environment. You know, this is a one where, you know, every time somebody does something that sniffs of being incorrect or overblown or whatever it is, they end up before Congressman Chaffetz, the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, explaining themselves, often only to have to cross the Hill and go over and explain to a Senate subcommittee the following day. So this is really one of those things where, do you want acquisition reform in this environment? Because once you start the process out, it might start with people who really understand that the business of government has to get done. But right now I'm thinking that it might not end up that way, and that we might want to wait just a little while until we have some cooler heads around, so that there's not always the gotcha mentality in government acquisition. Because government acquisition reform on the legislative side, Mark, doesn't happen very often. And when it does, we want to make sure that it's truly an improvement to what we have, not something that further sets us back and increases stumbling blocks and overall costs for everyone.
Well, I'm particularly amused when it counters the FAR and you're further exacerbating the issues 1102s face every day. You know, I already have three choices. You just gave me another one. What?
Well, right. And you're asking contracting officers sometimes to do what I call 52 contract pickup, which is to make choices among any one of a number of seemingly viable options. That's not a recipe for speedy short-term acquisition cycles.
I like the phrase seemingly viable options, right, too.
Because if they're only viable if you do them the way that, you know, the overseers think they should be done. So we don't need that. What we need is actually reducing the burdens there. Look, there was a lot of legislation put in over the past decade, most of it pursuant to Iraq and Afghanistan contractor issues. Those certainly need to be addressed. I'm not saying that they don't. But look, even the most wise congressman will admit that legislative approaches to these issues are more like a meat axe approach. They catch up a lot of people. They spatter a lot of people that weren't intended to be spattered. And that's kind of what's happened over the last decade. So when you're talking about acquisition reform, I think you're talking about taking some of those laws and better applying them to the situations in which they actually need to be applied, rather than casting a wider net over all of acquisition. And reducing competition, making it more difficult for small businesses to do business with the government. I talked to a number of people. I talked to two of the primary staff authors lately of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Clinger-Cohen Act, and they both agree that we almost need to go back to that era and restate what was stated in those laws so that we have what we thought we had the first time around. That's the type of acquisition reform we need. Unfortunately, my concern is that we might end up with more tripwires and requirements that ultimately shrink the size of the federal contractor market and don't serve anyone particularly well.
I got bad news for you. I had coffee with Bill Clinger 10 years ago, and the first thing he told me, he was so happy to be away from D.C. and he ain't coming back. So if you want Clinger Cohen again, find a couple of new offices.
Find a new people, that's right.
Bill Cohen's still around, though. He's still involved tangentially in the market. I'm going to take a break. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Larry and I will be back in just a few moments. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. If you want to listen to these shows, they're all archived at federalnewsradio.com. Just look up Amtower and you'll find a bunch of stuff, including probably half a dozen or so shows that Larry's done with me in the last year or so. So he's always great to have here. So there's a couple of things I want to do for wrapping up. First of all, you have the issues around most favored customer status. That's right. Always been kind of an issue.
There are a couple of things that are in play around most favored customer now, Mark. One of the things that I'm trying to emphasize to companies right now as we get into things that I know we're going to talk about more, like the GSA transactional data rule. And in the last segment, we were talking about the proliferation of burdens that have come about in the last decade to being a prime contractor. A lot of companies are increasingly looking at not being a prime. You know, I'd rather have another company hold my contract for me. That way the government can't come get me and I don't have to worry about compliance. Well, bad news for those companies that are thinking that way. Look, the bottom line is that the government, if they want to come and look at your books, whether you're a supplier, subcontractor, and the difference between those two, Mark, is in the government's decision-making only. They can call you one or the other, depending. If you're big enough and the government wants to come look at your books, they will find a justification to do that. And what I'm telling companies right now is that, look, yes, there are burdens from being a prime contractor. Yes, there's a lot of responsibility in terms of compliance. However, I find that companies that understand those challenges, put the infrastructure in place to manage the compliance burdens appropriately, and are paying attention, usually fare better in the event of an audit or a whistleblower case than the companies who get a false sense of security by not being a prime contractor themselves and thinking, well, you know, I have ABC company that's going to handle my federal contracting issues for me. I don't have to worry about it. I can do whatever I want. I'm sending ABC Company my equipment and providing them with my licensed service, but it's ABC Company that's performing this. And then you go off and you don't have a federal compliance person, or you don't take a federal contracting class, and you don't realize that, you know, you're still at risk, A, and B, exactly what you're at risk for. And if there's a problem, then the penalties and pain and suffering are likely much greater than if you had been paying attention in the first place.
Yeah. That leads me to a slightly different thing. You and I have talked about this offline. And when I first saw it, I pinged you and said, is this like for real? The transactional data rule, Now, it only applies to schedules. Is that accurate?
It does apply to schedules today. I think GSA is looking at ways to see whether or not they have essentially the same type of capabilities for their other IDIQ contracts. Generally, what GSA is really at here under the transactional data rule, Mark, is spending analysis, spend under management is the current term. So the transactional data is specific to schedules. But GSA across the board, as with NASA SOUP and some of the other major contracting agencies, really want to get a handle on spend under management and how their customers are using their contracts.
You know, NITAC has an EGOS dashboard that allows their buyers to see everything they purchased, who they got it from, when they got it, when it was delivered, and price paid.
Right. And one of the things that makes those systems easier to work for NITAC and for NASA SOUP is that those agencies actually touch every purchase order.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the schedules arena, GSA touches a very, very small minority of task orders. So thus the transactional data rule, where contractors are being required to set up systems to report on a monthly basis all of their GSA schedule sales. And all the information that you just touched on, Mark, you know, who we sold it to, what was the price paid, when did we sell it, you know, all of the relevant data, were there small businesses used, things of that nature. And it's potentially just a huge reporting burden on contractors. The government is going to have more of your data now than it had before. And to the extent to which all contractors have to make sure that any data you submit to the government has to be current, accurate, and complete, this is a huge surge in your compliance requirement.
Well, there's 20% of the companies on schedule that are going to say we're already compliant because they have no sales.
Right. There's companies that have no sales.
But the companies that are in that top 5% in each of the GSA schedule categories carry 60%+ of the sales. And in some instances, you're talking close to $500 million.
Right. And you have to really be careful in the IT and professional services market segments, Mark, because there are readily available alternatives to the GSA schedule in terms of contract vehicles.
And those big companies hold them.
Right. Well, whether it's NASA SOUP or NIH CIOCS or even something like a C-Port-E, those are readily available, viable contracts that companies actually do use and like, instead of government agencies, for some of the reasons you touched upon.
ITES.
If you're right, in the Army, if you're a professional services contractor, or a buyer, you have the OASIS contract that GSA manages, and you may decide that you want to do your business through that transaction method and not through the schedule. Look, I understand the government's desire to have spend under management and to get a better handle on what they're buying. There ought to be a better way, though, and in fact, there are better ways than the transactional data rule. My big concern here, Mark, is that in addition to the increased liability from the contractor standpoint, because you're going to be sharing a lot of data with the government that you don't have to share today, is also that when this gets populated into the database for comparison purposes, there are going to be a lot of inaccurate comparisons. Simply put, sometimes government contractor pricing really is multivariable calculus. And whereas I think the tendency is to look at schedule transactions as I'm going down to Home Depot and I'm going to aisle 3 and I'm going to get my paint thinner off of the shelf, what it really is more like is looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, where prices, terms, conditions change by the hour. And not all terms that affect market are particularly well understood. So we have to really understand that transactional data at its best is only going to be able to give the government part of what it needs. At its worst, it's going to cause a tremendous burden on contractors and could end up having the opposite of its intended effect to reduce pricing.
I pinged a couple of my friends who are, you know, C-level in the reseller arena, I don't think anybody was happy.
Well, no. I mean, I think, look, when the final rule came out, now about 2 weeks ago, I put out something that said the good, or at least the intended good, the unknown, and the not so good. There's enough here for people to like. There's enough here that should scare people if they're paying attention.
That's why we're not going to let this one die just yet.
Well, that's exactly right. And so I mentioned that I think it's going to have the opposite of the intended effect on lowering prices. Right now, since 1991, contractors have had the ability to offer lower prices on a spot basis without having to offer that lower price to every other federal agency.
Been a favorite end of FY tax.
Right. And it's benefited the government tremendously. Lower prices at the transactional level probably every day of the year than there are on schedule. But that's in large part because government contractors know that they're not going to have to offer that low price to everybody. And they can't offer that low price to everybody. Not everybody gets to buy things at below cost. So if contractors understand, and they should, that their pricing and discounting strategies are now going to be more transparent and scrutinized through the prices paid database, my betting mark is that they're not going to offer A, as many discounts, and B, the discounts that they offer won't be as deep as the ones that they have been offering. What's the net for the government? The net is fewer discounts available and discounts that are less in percentage than what they had. Net prices paid go up because of this project.
Scary stuff, my friend. Thank you very much for coming in.
Mark, been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on, and I wish everybody happy selling.
Happy selling, happy summer. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is not my day job. I advise companies large and small on all aspects of marketing to the government and leveraging social platforms and developing a subject matter expert platform. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.